This is Hubwonk. I'm your host, Joe Salvaggi. Welcome to Hubwonk, a podcast of Pioneer Institute, a think tank in Boston. On September 11th, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court heard oral arguments in a lawsuit brought by a group of small business owners, pastors, and a private school headmaster to determine if the governor's emergency actions in response to the COVID-19 epidemic were legal. The plaintiffs contend that Baker's orders, regardless of their laudable intentions, should be deemed invalid because they were issued under the state's 1950 Civil Defense Act, a law, they say, that does not apply to the coronavirus pandemic. My guest today is Jeff Jacoby, opinion columnist for the Boston Globe. In his September 9th piece entitled, Baker's Pandemic Orders Were Tough, But Were They Lawful?, Jeff explored the tension between well-intentioned crisis leadership and the need for elected officials to remain within their legal purview. Jeff considers whether the pandemic meets the standard for natural disaster and what the court must consider when making its decision. My co-host today is Jim Sturgis, executive director of Pioneer Institute. On September 1st, Jim co-authored an opinion piece in Commonwealth Magazine with State Senator Ryan Fatman entitled, Executive Branch Overreach, Blanket Orders Having Harmful Effects. In it, he argues that many of the lockdown measures have been harmful, poorly directed, and have imposed unnecessary harm to Massachusetts residents. While not taking position on the current lawsuit, his piece calls for the legislature to review and ratify executive orders as a way to respect legislative prerogatives. After a brief break, we'll be joined by Jeff Jacoby and Jim Sturgis. Okay, we're back. I'm your host, Joe Salvaggi, with Pioneer Institute's Jim Sturgis, and we're joined by Jeff Jacoby of the Boston Globe. Welcome back to the show, gentlemen.
Hey, Joe. How are you? Hi, Jim.
Good to be back.
Well, I think the show should start with a summary of the points made in the DeRozier versus Baker lawsuit. Jeff, your Globe piece made the point that the lawsuit is not about the intentions or the effects of the lockdown or the wisdom of the lockdown, but rather it's about whether the governor had the legal authority to do it. Why don't you tell our listeners your view on the facts in the case?
I've been skeptical from the very beginning of, for the past 6 months, ever since Governor Baker issued this emergency order and then started promulgating one mandatory decree after another. I've been skeptical about that as a way to make public policy, not because of the wisdom or unwisdom of any particular order, but because of the question of how law is supposed to operate in a free society. Quoted much in the briefs in this particular lawsuit is Article 30 of the Massachusetts Constitution. That was one of the original articles written by John Adams, and it's the one in which he has that famous phrase of, so that we may be a government of laws and not of men. And the point that Adams was making, and the point that I've tried to make in columns over the past few months, and certainly the point raised by the plaintiffs in this case, is that it's dangerous for any society that wants to remain free and well-governed to rely on the judgment of a single individual. It's the legislature's job to make laws, to delegate authority, not the job of the governor. That's what this whole suit turns on, whether Governor Baker, in issuing all these orders, actually had the legal authority to do so, or whether he was going beyond what the law prescribed, which would therefore, at least theoretically, mean that his orders have been without validity.
So beyond trying to be a Monday morning quarterback and litigate the past, what are your concerns? Let's say if this is well done by the governor, meaning we are a government of men for the time being, what are your concerns? Is it that there are no limiting principles? He's unaccountable? What are your concerns?
Well, this is one of those cases where I think the principle is really important. I think of two famous examples from American history from, two generations ago. Harry Truman tried to nationalize the steel industry during the Korean War and declared that he had the power to do so because he said he had the power to do so, and that he ought to have the power to do so because the United States was in a state of emergency, a state of war. The Supreme Court, in a famous landmark case back then, shot him down and said, Presidents don't have that authority. I think that was the right decision by the Supreme Court, even if, let's speculate, nationalizing the steel industry would have turned out to have been a good idea for the purposes of war production. But I also think of a case, and admittedly it's an extreme case, but one that will resonate with our listeners. Franklin Roosevelt issued an executive order saying that Japanese residents of the United States should be rounded up into internment camps because we were in a state of emergency, because there was a war with Japan, and it was important for the safety and the well-being of the public that all Japanese citizens and all Japanese residents be locked up. Supreme Court, as we know in that case, deferred to the president's judgment, and we look back now on the Korematsu case as one of the horror shows of American jurisprudence. In both cases, I think the presidents were doing what they thought was right. I think Charlie Baker has been doing what he thinks is right. I don't think anybody, except maybe some, you know, people on the fringes, I don't think anybody would deny the governor's, that the governor's acting with the best of intentions and that he's acting, you know, to do the right as he sees the right. But there's a really important principle. Where does someone in a democracy, in a free society, get the power to order his fellow citizens to do things? And the powers that Governor Baker has claimed that he has the right to invoke are incredibly sweeping. He claims the right to do all of what he's done under the Civil Defense Act, which was passed 70 years ago by the state legislature as a special law. It was not a general law. And it was, you could tell clearly when you read the statute or when you listen to the terms of the statute that it was written at the height of the Cold War, when there was great fear about sabotage, about foreign enemies, about a state of war. And there was a felt desire by the legislature that a governor needed to be able to act quickly if something that would qualify as a civil defense emergency were to erupt. The argument in this case is that the spread of disease and outbreak of disease, no matter how serious it is not a civil defense emergency. It's a public health emergency. And there's a public health law in Massachusetts. That's what Governor Baker should have invoked. The public health law goes back much further than the Civil Defense Act. It doesn't grant anything like the kinds of power that he's asserted in this case. And that's really that was the heart of this case. That's what it was really turning on. Whether or not the law that he invoked was actually applicable to this situation.
Okay, Jeff, you make some good points. I'm reminded that you do have a law degree and that you are well-versed in what legislators do and what executive branches do. It seems that many of the cases, I did have the privilege of listening to the oral arguments. Some of the SJC,
wasn't it?
It was interesting. And I think one of the more compelling arguments, they said, essentially, the governor is doing a pretty good job, and it's always the legislature's prerogative to weigh in and say, you know, stop seizing power. We've got it now, as if it's the legislature's job to oversee the governor rather than the other way around, perhaps.
Right. Justice Seifer, I think, was the one who was pushing that line pretty hard, saying if the legislature doesn't like what the governor's doing, it can always step up to the plate and tell him to stop doing it. What was the name of the lawyer for the plaintiffs? Michael DeGrandis, I think.
That's right.
Said, that's not the way law is supposed to work. You have the legislature, which makes the law, and you have the governor, the executive branch, which is supposed to administer the law, to carry out the law. The suggestion that unless the legislature says, you know, we don't like what you're doing, therefore you can keep doing it, that's no kind of answer. That opens the door to a governor who, let's imagine, has bad intentions, but is wildly popular and issues all kinds of outrageous orders. But because there's such a huge populist wind behind him, the legislature is fearful to stop him. That's exactly what Article 30 is trying to warn against. We have a system in this Commonwealth for the making of law, and we do it through lawmakers. If the lawmakers want to change the law, then that would be great. But to say, until they've spoken, therefore the governor, anything goes, and the governor can interpret any law any way he wants, that's just an invitation to open the Pandora's box.
Jim, I'd like to bring you into the discussion here because your piece in Commonwealth Magazine was fairly critical of the governor's approach, notwithstanding whether it was legal or not. Your piece is supported by a lot of the data Pioneer does on the effects of the pandemic and the lockdowns. What do you think the governor has done wrong, and what's your view of what could be done better?
Well, you know, I think our piece and Jeff's piece are complementary. I mean, Jeff is a trained lawyer, so I think his interest went to the law. My interests are in policy, and therefore that's where I ran. I think we end up in the same place, and that is that the legislature does need to approve things that the governor does over time. This can't just be the governor running ahead and making decisions based upon what he and his advisors believe are their best intentions. I think, look, there are two ways. The point of our piece was there are two ways to approach a crisis and a strategy to addressing a crisis. And you can either go big and broad and try to control your population, or you can go and run as fast as you can to the highest risks and to the biggest opportunities. And our piece is basically saying that the governor's attention and the attention of all of our government over the past 6 months have been really toward these big population control, the lockdowns, the executive orders, the executive authorizations. And that comes at the expense of an ability to address the biggest opportunities as well as the highest risk populations. And we know the highest risk population, that is the nursing home population, now accounts for 65% of almost 9,000 deaths in Massachusetts. Now, not all of that is the governor's fault at all, and I think the governor did what he could do, given where he was putting his attention. I think the problem is look, there were attempts to keep people out of the nursing homes, for example, but there was not enough testing internally, not enough training for people. There was not enough sick leave that was provided to folks. So if they're working in those facilities, that they would actually take time and step out of them. We're currently testing, I believe, people working in nursing homes somewhere between once every week and once every 4 weeks. That is completely insufficient to the task, and has a lot to do with testing overall. I know testing can be overstated, Joe. However, when you think that Boston University and Northeastern University themselves are testing 11,000 times daily, 11,000 people, and they're getting the results within 2 hours, and you compare that to what the state is doing, there's something truly wrong with our ability to ramp up testing. And the fact is, testing is important for a couple of things. One is the highest risk institutions, now including kids coming back to college, but also to facilitate the resumption of some semblance of normality in our social and our economic relations. Now, you know, most recently we have this case of the travel restrictions to Rhode Island. The fact is, if you do that and you try to get a test on the way back in, you're going to be sitting in one place for at least 3 to 5 days in many instances. It's just a complete wet blanket on any ability to actually travel, go back and forth, especially when you're talking about minuscule differences in contagion rates, infection rates between Rhode Island and Massachusetts. That's a case that for me really highlights how ludicrous all of this has become. So, I mean, there are a number of different aspects to the governor's approach. I'd say, you know, education is probably something we can talk about, because I think that's one place where that is crucial to getting people back to work. I also think it's a crucial piece of our society. I mean, it's in the Constitution that we have to make sure that kids are getting an adequate education, but we're flubbing that one majestically. It is amazing to see how poorly we're doing, especially when you put it in the context, not of the United States, but globally, how other people are approaching this issue.
You know, just to bring these two topics together in one, I'm just curious, Jim, to know whether you think, had Governor Baker's approach been not, I will issue unilateral directives based on decisions made only by myself and those who answer to me, but rather, let me go to the legislature and propose something and get feedback from the legislature and put it in the form of legislation. Had there been that broader consultation, especially with officials who don't answer to him, but who answer to their own constituents, at least some of whom presumably were dealing with, you know, problems like the ones in the nursing homes and in the schools, isn't it at least arguable that policy would have been better?
I think it's more than arguable. I'd make a distinction here. I think in the immediate aftermath of the outbreak, I think we almost necessarily ran into this situation where everyone wanted to have quick decisions made and people ensured of some level of safety, and lockdowns were, I think, a reasonable response. I think after you get past a month and a half or 2 months, all of that falls to the wayside. And here's the reason why I think it's arguable you would have had better policy responses. I'm going to reach out to my local rep as a parent, angry about what's happening in the schools. I'm going to reach out to my local rep about the fact that I can't see my dad who's in a nursing home, but the people who are working there aren't being tested, hadn't been tested for the first 3 months, which actually happened in many cases, right? That there's there, you're just much more of a porous, you have much more porous sort of access to the government writ large, legislature and governor, something you don't have with the governor. You have handlers on the part of the governor. They try to do their best, but that's one office essentially, right? So I think it is arguable, and I think it's probably, it's more than arguable, it's probable. That's all dependent on one thing, and that is that the legislators would have been responsible actors in all of this. And frankly, the legislature has, and this is to the Governor Baker's defense, just want to kind of say, hey, Charlie, you handle this, right? But they should have been held to account to do their jobs.
You know, I was talking with one state rep, you know, I won't mention names, but he's been critical of the governor of this. He's been especially critical, at least in his conversations with me, of what his fellow lawmakers were doing. He said they're perfectly happy to let the governor run with the ball.
Yep.
If everything works out right, it'll be good for them. And if things work out wrong, Charlie will have to take the blame.
Right.
You know, so I agree with you. The legislature hasn't been very responsible either.
Jeff, I just made build on Jeff's comment for a sec. Look, I really think that there's some people forget in all of this that we are in a learning mode. And the best way to learn is to make sure that people have a voice as to what their own personal experiences are at the localist level. And that feedback loop just wasn't there. So when I would just say that when I talk to people who are in the nursing home industry, and I would say, who have you been talking to? How have you been trying to get access to tests? They would say, it's just a big mess. It's hard to understand where to go. So having more conversations with your local officials gives them much easier access to information. They themselves calling from outside of government looking for that. So I think it just also provides a feedback loop to folks to actually understand what's happening. I have a feeling that many folks in the governor's, on the executive side, really didn't have a good grasp of how bad things were in the nursing homes until much, much too late.
I want to bring it back to the case that we're talking about, the Supreme SJC court case. There's a third actor or a third potential force in this debate, which is it's not just the governor versus the legislature. Many times we've cited the Public Health Act, which is precedes by nearly 50 years the Civil Defense Act. And what the plaintiff had argued was that rather than have a decentralized approach or an uncoordinated approach, rather the Commissioner Burrell could have connected with all the 294 different towns, each has its own public health department, and in a sense managed it in a coordinated way, but a comprehensive coordinated way, town by town, city by city. What do you think about that approach, which is to say we don't have the choice of necessarily only the governor or the legislature? One can argue the legislature is more responsive, more accountable, but why not have public health officials control public health issues?
I thought that was a very plausible argument. The briefs point out that there have been, since the Public Health Act was passed, numerous epidemics in Massachusetts, measles epidemic, flu epidemic. The law, at least in its original form, the Public Health Act, goes back to before the 1918 flu pandemic. So it isn't as though public officials in Massachusetts and public health officials in Massachusetts haven't had experience with things like if not COVID-19, then certainly with serious diseases. And the Public Health Act has functioned quite well. No governor ever felt the need, up until Charlie Baker, to invoke the Civil Defense Act to deal with a public health emergency. And, you know, all of this is is beside the question of how to actually the construction of the law itself. All of the governor's argument is based on the fact that in the Civil Defense Act, there's a phrase that says other natural causes. And on the strength of those three ambiguous words comes the entire assertion of power to act in this case, because, you know, COVID-19 is a natural cause. But laws are written to be interpreted by the language that goes into them, not by what someone, 50 or 100 years later might think ought to have been included. And one of the points that came up in the oral argument, one of the justices asked the lawyer for the plaintiffs, if the legislature wanted to amend the law now to say that the Civil Defense Act could be invoked in the case of a pandemic, would that would that answer your objections? And the answer was, to a large extent, yes. There are still some civil liberties concerns that we have and some Bill of Rights concerns, but all the legislature needs to do, if it really feels that a pandemic is a reason to invoke it, then by all means do so. But to simply come this late in the game and say, even though it's not in the law, I'm going to use that law anyway because it gives me more power, when no previous governor and no previous disease outbreak ever required that level of top-down control, I think it's illogical. And I would add to that, it makes more sense when you think about it that health issues should be dealt with locally and regionally as opposed to statewide. The laws that, the regulations that should apply in a dense population center like Boston don't need necessarily to apply in rural towns in Raleigh, Massachusetts, and in Greenfield, Massachusetts. The circumstances are bound to be very different than they are in Attleboro or Fall River or Boston. One of the things that the Public Health Act makes possible is the ability to deal with things as they are on the ground, not as they look from 30,000 feet up when you're in the governor's office.
And I think that's exactly right. And the ability to have some level of nuance would have prevented a lot of economic carnage, to use a term that's been much muddled by others' use of it. But it's we've seen responses that really don't match reality when you look at unemployment rates and you look at who's being affected economically and the level of infection rates in those localities. Second thing I just note on that is, if you think about this again from the policy perspective, what do you want to do when you go through a pandemic? You want to leave in place the infrastructure that is capable of dealing with it the next time. And by taking a much more public health approach to this, that is precisely what we would have been able to do, much like Singapore has done, Japan has done. That's why they've been able to respond to this locally and better.
Implied in your statement is, we want to build the muscle here, I guess, for the next event, right? Right now.
And there will be one. Right. There will be one.
Right, of course. Now, let's assume, and I think it's a big assumption or a stretch, that the SJC finds that the governor's orders were, in fact, not legal or not lawful. What would happen then? Do we know, would that invalidate all the executive orders? And let's say then they do, and we bounce it to the legislator. Are they then going to simply validate or reimpose the same rules? Or where do you see that going if it were to go against the government?
Anything can be speculated on. It's at least theoretically possible that the SJC could come back and say, plaintiffs are right. The governor had no authority to act under the Civil Defense Act. Therefore, his March 10 proclamation of an emergency was not authorized, and the orders that the 50 orders issued since then, were without legal justification. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, let's remember, 5 members of the SJC were appointed by Governor Baker. As I wrote in my column, and as I felt even more strongly after listening to the oral arguments, judges are reluctant to second guess an executive when he appears to be acting in public interest or in what's regarded as the public interest because of a terrible crisis that's immediately underway. So I'd be shocked if they really did strike it down in toto. But it's not inconceivable that the SJC would come back and say, although he had authority to act, it's not without time limitation. It can't go on forever. If COVID-19 is going to persist in having outbreaks for the next 3 years, next 5 years, the next 10 years, I mean, we're told that the flu, the strain of flu from 1918 continues to make its appearance. Does that mean that the state of emergency that Charlie Baker proclaimed in March could last indefinitely? The SJC might say, 6 months is enough. Anything beyond that, the legislature has to be heard on. What would happen if they clipped his wings in some way? I think that you'd hear voices in the legislature that would, start asserting themselves and saying, some of these restrictions really didn't make any sense. It's not logical to say that you can have hundreds of people shopping at Home Depot or at Stop and Shop, but you can only have 40 people in a church on a Sunday, just for example. And they might, I could see the legislature, wanting to have a little bit more substantive control over what these orders allow. or, you know, depending on what the positivity and death toll, you know, death rates are looking like, they might just pass a law saying, yes, going forward, the Civil Defense Act can be invoked in the case of a disease outbreak, and, you know, and let the governor reissue those orders. I don't know. I mean, I'm just, you know, spitballing here. Anything is conceivable. You never know how a court is going to act in a case like this.
You know, I'll bet what would happen in the short term is the legislature would just step in and support what the governor has done thus far. The thing that's really interesting, what it sets off, it's not what happens in the immediate term. And just to think about education for a second, you've got about 950,000 kids in public schools, lots and lots of parents, very, very upset. And right now their only recourse is to have to try and engage with their local superintendents to say, or their mayor, let's say, and say, look, we're not happy with this situation. The fact is the communication, let's say, between representatives, legislators, and the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education would go up vertically if the legislature all of a sudden decided just to support what Charlie Baker was doing legislatively, which has allowed for the department and the local districts to do what they're doing, which is to not teach terribly much and to come up with some pretty haphazard solutions. That over time, you can just imagine the number of phone calls that go into the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education for the legislators, because they're going to get a lot of calls from their constituents saying, this is just untenable. We've got all these kids who are in K-6 schools and they're not actually attending in person, or the hybrid classes aren't working as well, or their online classes aren't working. Over time, that takes its toll, and the department has to be much more responsive, something they haven't been thus far. So it's not what they do in the immediate term. It's the legislative process, you know, the infrastructure of our legislative process is that, you know, people call their legislators and they get angry and they say, we don't like X, Y, and Z. And that gives much more pressure to the executive branch offices.
I want to develop that idea a little bit more, in that if we say natural disaster, or if this law is upheld, or the governor's orders are upheld largely because it's natural and it's a disaster and it doesn't have a natural beginning, middle, and end, so that it's essentially open-ended. We're somewhere between the beginning panic phase and the sort of what do we do now phase. When do you think that's going to shift? When do you think the electorate is going to say, look, we feel somewhat safe. We've gone, in this case, a week without any deaths. Our new cases are low. My kid's still not at school. I still have these restrictions that seem arbitrary and without logic. Where does the next step happen? Where does the electorate assert itself and say, we need a new path forward?
You're saying apart from whatever the court might do.
Yes. Well, assuming the court does nothing.
Yeah. Good question. I think probably for different demographics and different communities, it'll happen at different rates. You know, I one of the things that's interested me, that I have found interesting over the past few months, depending on where you are, you see very different levels of mask wearing. You know, for a while there, when the gyms were closed, so I would, and I got sick and tired of only going for long walks from my house in Brookline. And I had seen every conceivable permutation that you could see from where I was. So I would get in the car and I would go drive 15 miles or 20 miles and get out, park, and, you know, walk a few miles there. And in some places, you know, you walk the streets of Brookline or the streets of Cambridge or the streets of Somerville, and everybody has a mask on. It's become so unthinkable to be seen, even in public, even if there's nobody within a block of you, to be seen without a mask. You go to Waltham, and it was almost, I could go for blocks and pass scores of people, none of whom was wearing a mask. So I think different communities have different tolerance levels for this kind of thing. Maybe some of it is, you know, based on the blue collar versus white collar. Some of it might be based on age. Some of it might be based on, you know, what kind of schooling their kids are getting. Some of it might be based on local disease rates. Some of it probably is based on political ideology. But if we're looking for a specific event that I think would really start to shift opinion, I'm going to guess maybe the rolling out of a vaccine to combat the virus. Maybe if it starts to become relatively easy for people to go and get vaccinated, maybe that would have a real dampening effect on the idea that we're in a crisis that calls for total control from the governor I don't know. Jim, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the answer is take a look at gasoline purchases. If you go and you're back in May, there was so little traffic. It was amazing to all of us. It's very quiet. In some ways, it was nice because if you were driving a car, you got to where you wanted to get within a couple of minutes. The gasoline purchase
has been since then.
What I'm saying is I think really in August, the lid came off. And people are back out on the street. They're back driving. Obviously, not in downtown Boston, which looks like someone let off a neutron bomb or something. Elsewhere, people are moving about. They're going about their business. They are taking precautions, but they don't feel it's a crisis nearly as much. I think we've passed from the crisis stage. The thing that would put us back in a crisis stage is a second outbreak. And then after that, I think we have to look, it's a second outbreak, and then it's the vaccine, whether they can actually roll it out in November, December, January, whatever. Those are the breaking points, I think. But I don't feel like we're in a crisis mode anymore. Maybe certain communities, and I think you named them, Jeff, still have that feeling, and that's because of density of population, the impacts they'd seen before. If you're in Chelsea, I would expect that still you're thinking this is truly a crisis because it did hit you so hard. But I think elsewhere, and that's just on the basis of facts on the ground, it doesn't feel like that nearly as much now.
You both mentioned vaccines, and I'm reluctant to go there. It could probably be its own show. But let's not to open up.
It has been, Joe. It has.
Given that there is some hope that a promising vaccine is on the horizon, let me ask you a personal question. Are both of you going to get first in line, second in line? To what extent would you support some sort of state mandate after saying we're not for executive orders on this show? Where does the legislative role line up in mandating a vaccine in your mind?
Speaking personally, I would certainly go get, I would get vaccinated. If my doctor says, the vaccine is what you ought to take, go get it, I would. But I have loved ones who have very different opinions about this subject, and I know that people can, in good faith, come down on both sides of it. I don't know that I would be first in line or even second in line, but I'm certainly not, not opposed to a vaccine. I don't know really what to make the Globe had a story. I think it was the Globe had a story about the huge disparity between white residents and black residents and how willing they are to trust a vaccine or to get vaccinated or to trust in the efficacy of a vaccine. And I don't know how you grapple with that. I mean, the idea that that something like race should be deterring people from getting health care that they're, that the doctors are advising them to get is disturbing. But I wouldn't want to mandate it either. I mean, this whole, we're talking here about a case that's all about how much authority do we want to empower, to delegate to government officials to force people to do things that they don't want to do and that they think might be bad for them. And I think if someone is nervous and unwilling to get a vaccine, to get vaccinated because they think it's going to hurt them or because it might do damage, I don't know. There's part of me feels very uneasy about the idea that we would mandate it and force it against their will. I know that there's legal authority to do that, but I don't like it.
Yeah, I guess my take on it is I'm going to read everything I can about the efficacy and the downside risks and make my decision based upon what I see on the other side. I don't expect that any vaccine is going to be 95% efficacious, or we'll have to see what that looks like. So I want to reserve my decision about whether to get vaccinated the first round on the basis of the facts on the ground at the last point. But, on the issue of should vaccines be, assuming it's a really good vaccine, just for the sake of argument, we're talking about 99% efficacious, no real downside risks, that we should mandate that for people. I guess I would be open to, and I haven't thought this all the way through, but I'd be open to, if you're going to use public services in enclosed spaces, I'm not talking about parks, I'm talking about public schools, the MBTA, that there would be a mandate to have to be vaccinated to use those services. I think I'd be probably open to it. I haven't thought about all the legal ramifications of it, but that seems to me somewhat reasonable. But I don't think a broad-based mandate is appropriate.
How would you do it with a T? I mean, I can
see, I know. I know. I'm thinking very theoretically here, right. Jeff.
School, I can certainly see it with students to say, if you want a student to be enrolled, whether it's nursery or college, you know, they have to show proof that they've been vaccinated. But to get on the T?
I completely get it. But I'm just saying theoretically in your head, how do you construct that? And then you try to think about it. Maybe you have to wear the scarlet letter if you don't, you know, you don't take the vaccine. I don't know. So, I mean, that's just generally how I'm thinking about it theoretically right now. But
well, we're getting close to the end of the show. And I think we've come down on these lines of if executive orders are effective, we should let them happen. We can all think about that a little more deeply. But let's assume we have our legislators' ear, that they listen to the show, both legislators and the governor's office. What do you recommend their best path forward? We're here, you know, we're in the middle of September. It's a combination of colder weather ahead of us, or perhaps the promise of a vaccine. We don't know whether things are going to get better or worse. What would you like to see legislators or the governor do next?
You know, one of the issues that came up during the oral argument, and which is discussed in the briefs, even though I didn't mention it in my column, it hasn't come up in the conversation so far today, is the question of due process. And one of the points that the plaintiffs make, it may not meet with much success, but one of the points that they make is that there's no due process afforded to anybody who's been affected by any of these orders that have come up from the governor. And let's remember, tens of thousands of people lost their jobs. Thousands of businesses have gone belly up because of this. You know, a lot of people have paid a really severe price as a result of complying with orders that were issued by the governor, to which they had no recourse. There was no way for them to object. There was no way for them to get a hearing, no way for them to, I mean, short of filing a lawsuit, there was no way for them to say, you know, listen, my business is in a location where it's not going to, you know, there's not going to be a lot of exposure to the public. I shouldn't have to close. I would like the legislature in general to think about questions of procedural due process and not to be so quick about saying we're going to allow orders to be imposed from on high, and people will just have to, you know, live it, you know, like it or lump it. There was one colloquy during the oral argument where one of the justices asked the assistant attorney general, who was arguing on behalf of Baker, I forget exactly what example he used, but the justice said, you know, isn't it true that, you know, such and such a party and such a kind of business, you know, paid a really heavy price? And the assistant AG's answer was yes, and that's unfortunate. You know, lines have to be drawn, and some people get affected more harshly than others. And the justice reacted with yes, you know, that is true. It's all very sad. I think we need due process, because acknowledging that something is sad isn't really, you know, I mean, that's not really always sufficient, especially when you're talking about things that for a lot of people are at least as important as their health. Nobody minimizes the importance of public health. But nobody should minimize the importance of a functioning economy and what it means to countless families when, you know, when businesses are forced out of work, out of operation.
Yeah, I wholly agree with that. I mean, you see that especially in some of the differentiation during the early executive orders between big box stores that were able to open and their competitors who were small family-owned businesses that were not able to do that. These are people who had assumed a whole bunch of debt, and it may have ruined their lives for 5, 6, 7 years. I mean, this is not a small matter. It's not like losing your job, which is already really bad. It's about losing your job and all your investments and your ability in many cases to actually make another investment start again. So, I mean, I think Jeff is spot on. I'd love to see the legislature do these two things. One is to have a special committee that reviews the impacts on people of what has happened thus far. So you can daylight all that, give people a place they can actually complain, say what happened, articulate it. So if we're going to have any more of these executive orders, they're informed by that. But even better would be a legislative process, maybe again, a special committee that is advising the legislature on all the different things the executive branch is doing along the way so they can approve or not approve what he's doing. We at least have to have that kind of close management of what the executive branch is doing. If not, which would be even better, a reversal to the legislature actually promulgating laws, the governor signing them or not signing them, and going back into that regular process, legislative process we had before. I think we're grown-ups. I think we can handle that now. The first couple of months, I do grant that the governor really did have to lead this, but we are far past the era of fear and running to shelter ourselves from everything. We actually know a lot more about this disease right now.
So we're at the end of the show. So if we're going to sum up our view, the time for tacit approval by the legislature is perhaps past. Now they have to actively roll up their sleeves and engage and deliberately choose a way forward, not based on executive orders.
They should do so even if the Supreme Judicial Court doesn't tell them to do so. They should do so as a matter of wanting to do their jobs properly.
Wonderful. That's a great way to tie the two columns and two points of view together. Thank you very much, gentlemen. You made for a very good show, a lot to think about. Thanks for joining HubWonk.
Thank you very much.
This has been an episode of HubWonk. I'm your host, Joe Salvaggi. If you enjoyed today's show, there are several ways you can support us. You can offer a 5-star rating, you can subscribe to the show, and you can give us a review. Please feel free to share it with friends as well. If you'd like to reach out to me with comments or suggestions about future episodes, you can reach me at hubwonk@pioneerinstitute.org. HubWonk is a podcast of Pioneer Institute, a think tank in Boston. If you're interested in joining Pioneer or supporting this show, again, please feel free to reach out to me at hubwonk@pioneerinstitute.org. Please join me next week for a new episode of HubWonk.